Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Hey guys, welcome back to Storytime Slayer Podcast. Today we're going to discuss an arson investigation that ultimately solves an almost 30-year-old murder case, all because the killer just couldn't quit talking. There's nothing I love more than a narcissist feeling so confident in themselves that they tell on themselves ultimately. Thank you so much for tuning into Storytime Slayer Podcast. I am your hostess with the mostest, Haley Lira, and I love doing this podcast. I'm so glad you could join me. Go check out my Facebook, Storytime Slayer, or my Instagram, story_time_slayer. That's where I post photos and anything pertaining to these cases. This is a small podcast, so a like, follow, and share goes a really long way for me. So does a 5-star review. Again, this is a true crime podcast, so I will be outlining and discussing heinous crimes. Listener discretion is advised. With that being said, let's jump in. Ohio man Scott Perk was 46 when his house caught on fire in 2009. Fortunately, Scott, his wife, and their two children made it out of their home safely. Sadly, their pet ferret did not. When the fire started, Scott said he'd been in bed with his wife and they heard what sounded like an explosion. So he got up, looked out the window, and saw a fire. He immediately began evacuating his family from the home. Scott then told the police that he'd seen suspicious vehicles in the area earlier that day. And luckily, Scott had found them so suspicious, he actually wrote down their description and license plate numbers and was able to give that information to the police. But while there, police started to get a vibe from Scott. They almost immediately suspected insurance fraud just by his overall demeanor and his reaction in response to the fire. What they would uncover, though, was so much more heinous than just insurance fraud. Upon arriving to the scene, Scott's minivan stood out to investigators because it had been reversed, like, towards the end of their driveway away from their home. And the minivan was filled with family heirlooms and items of serious sentimental value. So the police were like, wow, like, what are the chances? And when they asked Scott about his van, he said that him and his son planned to make a trip the following day to visit family. And so they'd packed up some of that stuff to take with them to, I guess, reminisce with family. I'm not sure. Then to make things weirder, Scott just starts word vomiting the weirdest things. So first, he told police that he was lucky he'd made a video documenting all of his valuables for such a situation such as this, which is smart, but given the minivan situation, it's also kind of suspicious. Then Scott disclosed he and his wife were actually in an open relationship, and earlier that evening, his wife had been on a date with their son's martial art instructor. I don't know if Scott mentioned this so that maybe they would think, oh, the martial art instructor did this because he's a jealous lover, or what the point of that story even was. So police are kind of scratching their head at this guy. Then Scott starts saying even weirder stuff. So Scott mentioned he was currently in a substantial amount of debt. He had a criminal history of robberies dating back to 1986, which he served 7 years in prison for. And to top it off, he told authorities his first wife actually committed suicide while pregnant in 1985. As if all this wasn't odd, the fire was quickly determined to be arson and an investigation quickly launched. Police are like, something's not right with this guy. One of the detectives over the Perk arson investigation was so suspicious, he actually decided to launch a separate investigation into the death of Scott's first wife, Meg Perk, because Scott gave him such ick vibes. This is one of those situations where the universe just aligns. See, Meg Perks had been deceased 24 years and her death was ruled a suicide, case closed. So nobody was still pointing the finger. This was many years ago. And had Scott not put off such a vibe and just happened to mention Meg's death, none of what comes next would have ever even happened. So anyway, we're going to talk about the death of Meg Perk and the 1985 robbery Scott committed following her death, and then we're going to circle back to 2009. Meg's actual full name was Margaret. She was born in New York in 1960. Her friends and family describe her as quiet and reserved, but also very kind and loving. Meg enjoyed writing poetry, and some of her poems were even published. She was an excellent student and friend growing up, but did have depressive tendencies as a teenager. Meg disclosed to a girlfriend she once tried to kill herself in high school and again at the age of 18. Unfortunately, those attempts failed, but Meg's depression and suicidal thoughts didn't seem to follow her into adulthood. I don't know exactly how Meg met Scott, but when she did, her family was less than impressed with him. The couple didn't seem like a match because Meg was rather reserved and Scott was outgoing and eccentric in a very annoying way to her friends and family. In fact, the more Meg's friends and family got to know Scott, the more that they disliked him. The family said that he was a habitual liar and they thought Meg was way too good for him. Despite this, though, Meg and Scott were married in 1981, and in 1984, Meg got pregnant with their first child. She was so excited to become a mother. Unfortunately, that wouldn't happen. March 18, 1985, Scott called 911 from their apartment in Akron, Ohio, to report his 24-year-old, 8.5-month pregnant wife had attempted to kill herself and he needed an ambulance. When EMS arrived, they found 24-year-old Meg lying at the bottom of the apartment staircase with a rope around her neck. She had no pulse, but they were able to revive her and transport her to the hospital. Unfortunately, Meg and her unborn child died hours later. When police spoke with Scott about what happened leading up to this tragedy, he said everything had been great. Meg was really happy, in a really good mood, and excited about the pregnancy up until this last month. That's when Meg became depressed and suicidal again. That morning, on March 18th, Scott said Meg hadn't been feeling that great and they were actually planning to go see the doctor. When Meg killed herself, Scott said he had actually been taking a bath but had the door open. And while he was just sitting there relaxing, he saw Meg walk by him in the hallway. So he decided to get out and check on her. And that's when he found her hanging from the second story stair railing. He was unable to unknot the rope Meg used, so instead he used a steak knife to cut her down and then called 911. Investigators were kind of questioning his story from the beginning because suicide victims don't typically commit suicide in an open, visible space with someone in the home. It's more common for them to go somewhere that they're not going to be immediately found or interrupted. Because of that, police actually checked for any signs of forced entry to see if maybe someone broke in while Scott was in the bath or any other plausible explanation, but they found nothing. Only Scott and Meg were in the apartment that day. Not only was this not typical for a suicide, but Meg's family and friends insisted, despite Meg's past depression, she was not suicidal as an adult. In fact, it was quite the opposite. Meg was really happy. They pointed the finger at Scott and stressed to the police he was nothing but a liar and troublemaker. When confronted with suspicions that Scott had killed Meg, he adamantly denied it and stuck to his original story, insisting Meg was depressed and suicidal at the time of her death. He even gave detectives a poem he found that Meg wrote alluding to death and suicide, and he told them this could possibly be her suicide note because there was no other note found. However, when police brought this poem up to Meg's family, they said that they'd all seen that poem because it was old. It was not a new poem. She did not just write that, like Scott claimed. Something else that didn't align with Scott's story was when police searched him and Meg's apartment, they found a letter Meg wrote to her grandma a short time before her death, where she talked about how excited and happy she was to be having a baby. Nothing in this letter was consistent with someone unhappy or suicidal like Scott claimed she'd been for at least a month. As suspicious as all this is, though, it's circumstantial, and police had to wait for Meg's autopsy report to come back. Unfortunately, when the autopsy report came back, it was no help because it did rule that Meg died by suicide and the case was closed. Investigators say that they had a really hard time believing Meg committed suicide, but didn't have anything they could really do at the time. So she was buried with her baby in her arms and life went on. 5 months following Meg's death in August of 1985, several burglaries happened in the Akron area to both residences and businesses. With no good leads, police put out a description of the suspect on the news and in the newspapers. Meg's best friend Dawn just happened to see this sketch that police put out and thought, man, that guy really looks a lot like Scott Perks. So she called and reported this to the police. Police go and talk to Scott and he immediately confessed to the burglaries and he blamed his actions on the recent death of his wife and unborn son. He's ultimately charged with 6 counts of aggravated burglary and 1 count of grand theft auto after breaking into 9 separate places. Reports are conflicting, but I think Scott got sentenced to 10 years in prison after pleading no contest, but ultimately served 7 years and was paroled in 93. I don't know a whole lot about Scott's burglaries, but what I do know is he stole $1,000 worth of equipment from a telephone company during one of them, a 1983 Chevy Cavalier, and he attacked one of his victims with nunchucks. While in prison, Scott obtained his law degree. At some point, I don't know when, Scott met his second wife, Tammy, and they get married and they have two kids together, a son and a daughter. Okay, so now let's get back to 2009. Okay, so like I said, after the house fire and police came out, it was quickly ruled an arson case and potential insurance scam. Police take a look at Scott's debt. Remember, Scott's the one who told police he was in a lot of debt, which was very true. Scott had around $100,000 worth of debt, and had he gotten away with burning down his house, he stood to gain about $150,000. Things are not looking good for Scott. Now, police did try to hunt down these suspicious cars and license plates Scott Solon reported, but none of them led to anything. As for the investigation into Meg's death 24 years prior, things also weren't looking super good for Scott. After learning everything surrounding her death and the circumstances, investigators took a look at the original autopsy photos. Okay, side note. So at the time of Meg's death in 1984, the county she lived in did not have a board-certified ME. So I assume that means one of two things. One, her autopsy either wasn't done by a board-certified ME, or two, it was done by a board-certified ME in another county who presumably had a larger workload, leaving more room for error, unfortunately. Regardless, investigators taking a fresh look at her case in 2010 reviewed the original autopsy photos and found the ligature marks on Meg's neck weren't consistent with the rope that was found around her. Instead, the ligature marks looked more like they were consistent with a belt. Investigators did several tests using ropes and belts to support their theory. Then investigators found out a very short time after Meg and her baby died, Scott had quickly moved in with a new girlfriend. This woman was likely Scott's motive for killing his wife and unborn baby, so police track her down. And y'all, she did not have anything good to say about Scott, okay? She said he was, quote, the craziest person I've ever met in my life, end quote. And she went on to say he was a horrible human being, and he actually told her himself that he killed his ex-wife. Now, I know I shouldn't judge this woman who I don't know, but I just cannot imagine an ex who I thought was just a miserable piece of shit telling me to my face that he murdered his 8.5-month pregnant wife and never telling the police. Like, I can only assume she was afraid, but good God, it's been like 25 years now. Investigators had gathered enough suspicious evidence to move forward and have Meg's body exhumed for a second examination. This time, for sure, by a board-certified ME with time on their hands. So at this time, I don't think Scott knew police were reinvestigating Meg's death following the 2009 house fire. So while all that's going on behind the scenes, a suspicious fire breaks out at some duplexes in Stone, Ohio in 2010. And the way these duplexes were set on fire is eerily similar to the way Scott Perk's home had been set on fire. So similar that police almost immediately theorized Scott did this so that he could take the suspicion off himself and make it look like there was an arsonist on the loose and his family was just innocent victims. Police get a search warrant for Scott's home, where he'd been staying after the fire. And luckily, Scott is an idiot because in his house, police found muddy boots that were a perfect match with muddy boot prints that were found at the duplexes, as well as a gas can just sitting inside his house. September of 2011, both Scott and his wife, Tammy, were arrested and indicted for both fires and insurance fraud. Tammy pled guilty to minor charges and only got 1 year probation. January of 2013, Scott pleads guilty to 6 counts of attempted aggravated arson, attempted aggravated murder, insurance fraud, endangering children, and disrupting public services. He's sentenced to 28 years in prison for that. I'm not gonna lie, I was a bit shocked about his sentencing, to be honest, but of course I'm glad. Just a little shocked, like, way to lay down the hammer on this guy. Okay, so we're going to circle back into the investigation into Meg's death. Meg was exhumed September of 2011, and everyone involved in Meg's second investigation was concerned that there would not be any remaining viable evidence on Meg. To make matters worse, when they pulled Meg's casket out of the ground, it was completely full of water. Now, this is usually a very concerning sign because water often washes out evidence, but luckily, Meg and her baby were very well preserved. When a board-certified ME examined her corpse, it was very clear the ligature marks on Meg's neck were, in fact, from a belt and not a rope that she supposedly hung herself from. Also, the trajectory of the ligature marks on her neck did not match that of somebody hanging. If she'd hung herself, the ligature mark would be in an upward direction from her weight, pulling it down, but it was more of a backwards direction on her neck than upwards. There was a mark visible on Meg that I don't think was ever documented in her first autopsy exam. It was on her back, and it was in the perfect shape and spot for Scott to have placed his knee onto her. So the theory is that Scott put a belt around Meg's neck, placed his knee on her back, and then pulled the belt, ultimately suffocating her. This was clearly a homicide and not a suicide. Police now had a working theory that fit the forensics perfectly, too. As for the rope, okay, so there was a line across Meg's chest that the original investigators thought was from her bra strap, but when the second set of investigators re-examined it, they found it was actually from the rope that Scott pretended and staged around Meg's neck to look like that's what she used to kill herself, and the line across her chest was from Scott dragging her lifeless body across the floor with that rope to stage her. Investigators took it a step farther and went to the same apartment Scott and Meg had shared and lived in when she died in 1985. Apparently, everything was the same. So when they say that, I'm assuming they mean that the staircase and railings hadn't been changed out or remodeled. They're the original staircase and railings that were there when Meg and Scott lived there. And when police take a closer look at the railings Meg supposedly hung from, it wasn't consistent with Meg having hung from it because the rail lacked an indentation her body weight would have created with the rope in the wood, like a little groove. The courts determined this is enough evidence. In January of 2014, Scott was indicted for the murder of Meg. So this is a year following his 28-year sentence for all the arson drama, and his trial for Meg began November of 2015. Unfortunately, due to so much time passing and a lot of evidence from the original case into Meg's death in 1985 had been destroyed prior to the new investigation, because destroying evidence after a period of time is pretty typical when a case is ruled suicide. You know, police departments have protocols for how long they keep that sort of stuff. But fortunately, the new evidence was enough to charge Scott. Scott pled not guilty and was super arrogant during the trial, like he thought he'd get away with Meg's murder twice. However, Scott was found guilty and sentenced 15 years to life. But according to the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, he isn't expected to be released until March of 2050. And unless something changes, his first parole hearing isn't scheduled until February of 2050. So Scott would be 87. It is a little bit weird that he got 28 years for arson and 15 to life for murder. I wanted to cover this case because it's a very strange way for a murder to be solved. Had Scott not word vomited to the police about Meg's death, would he have ever been caught for it? Would her family have ever actually got the satisfaction of him going to prison specifically for that? Probably not. As for what happened to his second wife, Tammy, I found her on Facebook and LinkedIn. It's pretty private though, but she looks to still be living in Ohio and working at Walmart. I found it kind of odd she didn't change her last name, so I take it she may still be married to Scott, but at the very least, she hasn't remarried or rechanged her name. I saw several posts about their son, who it looks like joined the military, but I mean, that's really the closest to an update I got. Thank you so much for tuning into Storytime Slayer Podcast, and I will talk to you next week. Bye. And since we're at the very end of the episode, I do want to go ahead and say, if you guys heard that incessant beep noise every now and then, it is a smoke detector battery, and I cannot find it. Like, I cannot find this smoke detector. I can hear it. I've literally laid hands on every smoke detector. I don't even live in a big house. I don't know what's going on, but my apologies. Hopefully I'll find it by next week. Bye.